So this week we are looking at Majjhima Nikaya number 78, the Samana Mandika Sutta. And this particular one has one corresponding Chinese discourse in the Agamas, Majjhima Agama 179. And here, let's see better. And as usual, the two discourses are very similar. And we'll be looking at this with both the Pali and the English translation in front of us. Okay, here we go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove in Atapindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, the wanderer Uggahamana Samanamandika Putta was staying at Malika's Park, the single-halled Tinduka plantation for philosophical debates, together with a large following of wanderers, with as many as 300 wanderers. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a little footnote there. Does anyone want to read out Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote?
And beautiful with flower trees and fruit trees. At first only one who was built, which counts for its name, but after two more books. Various companies of Brahmins and wanderers would assemble there to expound and discuss their doctrines.
Okay, so Bhikkhu Bodhi's taken a slight bit of license here with using the word philosophical debates. Actually, there's no particular word in Indic languages which exactly corresponds with what we call philosophy. Philosophy, of course, meaning love of wisdom. But the actual word here is samaya pavadake. Pavada is a discussion or a debate. And the samaya, in this context, samaya literally means a system or something like that, a system or a doctrine or something like that. So for discussion of doctrines, something like that. Okay, so curious. Bhikkhu Bodhi says 300 wanderers. Pali here says 500 wanderers. So there's presumably different readings in the different texts, I would imagine. Which would be more likely, 300 or 500? They normally have 500, yeah.
Yeah, 500,
yeah. So 500 is more likely, is that right? Having a debate, yeah. If you applied the principle of, what do they call it, lectio difficultior, I never know how to pronounce it in the Latin phrase, then the more obscure reading is to be preferred.
Which is the 300.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because editors tend to make things, it would be more likely for an editor to silently correct it from 300 to 500, because 500 is more common. Then the other way around. Can that focus be adjusted at all? Is it a bit blurry or is it just my eyes? Oh dear. Sadhu. Get a cloth or a towel or something. Don't waste huge amounts of tissues on it. Just get down there. Well, that's exactly. That's all right. Just ring it up. It's fine. The floor's clean.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. That is all the time.
It's sacred.
The whole making a castle out of gherkins, making a house.
Coffee's nice.
No, it hasn't.
I've
pieced
it.
Oh, do you? Okay. Looks, yeah, looks a bit sharper. Okay. So, wanderer Panchakanga, the carpenter Panchakanga, went out from Savatthi at midday in order to see the Blessed One. Then he thought, it is not the right time to see the Blessed One, he's still in retreat. So, in retreat here doesn't mean in a long-term retreat, it just means he's off in quiet time, Patisalina. And it is not the right time to see the bhikkhus worthy of esteem. And this is an interesting phrase, Manu Bhavaniya Nambi Bhikkhunam. So Manu almost literally is worthy of esteem. It's for whom the mind should be developed. It's almost a literal translation. It's an idiom. They are still in retreat. Suppose I went to Malika's park, to the wanderer Ugahamana Samanamandika Putta. Ugahamana means grabber. The grabber, Samana is a Samana. Mandika, I'm not sure what Mandika is. Son of Mandika, that's what Mandika means. Okay, and he went to Malika's park. Of course, Queen Malika, as Annie just mentioned, was the favourite wife of King Pasenadi, originally a flower girl who was spotted by the king and made into his queen. And she had many, many dialogues between King Pasenadi and Malika. In fact, Malika was much more intelligent than he was, and she was the one who converted him to Buddhism. So, now on that occasion, the wanderer Ugahamana was seated with a large assembly of wanderers who were making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking many kinds of pointless talk, such as talk of kings and so on, and whether things are so or are not so. Okay, as in the previous few suttas that we've looked at. The wanderer Ugahamana Samanamandika Putta saw the carpenter Panchakanga coming in the distance. Seeing him, he quieted his own assembly thus, "Sirs, be quiet, sirs, make no noise. Here comes the carpenter Panchakanga, a disciple of the recluse Gotama, one of the recluse Gotama's white-clothed lay disciples staying at Savatthi." Here's the carpenter is a tapati. And the Udata Vasana is the white clothed lay disciple, Nihi Udata Vasana. These venerable sirs like quiet. Okay. And so here the word that's used for the lay person is ayasmanto. Ayasma literally meaning one who is endowed with life or a long lived one, and is usually the term used for bhikkhus, although in the Pali itself is a bit ambiguous. Here we see a bunch of wanderers referring to a lay disciple as ayasma, but you also see the same thing even in the Patimokkha, where the bhikkhus occasionally refer to lay people as ayasma as well. So generally it's a respectful term, but it's used with a degree of flexibility. They are disciplined in quiet. They commend quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us. Then the wanderers became silent. So of course always this kind of slight implication of the hypocrisy of the wanderers, that they're only becoming silent not because they want to develop their minds, but because they want to try to impress others. The carpenter Panchakanga went to the wanderer Ugahamana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down on one side. The wanderer Ugahamana then said to him, "Carpenter, when a man possesses four qualities, I described him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, and ascetic invincible." Okay, ascetic invincible. Samanang Ayodhang. So this is ayodhyang. This is a slightly unusual word here. It's probably a technical term from the particular wanderer sect, and but it's from the root yudha, meaning a warrior, which of course is where the where you get the word yodha is actually a warrior. Yudha being the yudha is a, like an adjective form. The yodha is the warrior, and of course that's where George Lucas got Yoda from. And here is ayodhya, means can't be defeated even by Yoda. So truly invincible. Okay, what are the four? Here he does no evil bodily actions. He utters no evil speech, he has no evil intentions, and he does not make his living by any evil livelihood. When a man possesses these four qualities, I describe him as accomplishing what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic invincible attained to the supreme attainment. Okay, so these are quite high, obviously very high praises of these things. Sampanna kusalam is endowed or perfected in what is kusala, what is good for. Parama, the highest, what is good for. Uttama, attained, like is the highest or the supreme practice attained to the supreme attainment. The samana, ascetic invincible. Okay, what for? So here he doesn't do the bad behavior by body, by kayena, by vacha, okay, by speech, is sung, and then by sankappa, is by intention, and does not make an evil livelihood, ajivam, ajivati. Okay, so you can immediately notice that several of these terms are the same as the terms found in the Eightfold Path, right speech, right intention, right livelihood. Okay. Then the wanderer Panchakanga neither approved nor disapproved of the wanderer Ugahamana's words. Okay. Neva abhi nandi na patikosi. And so this is a very nice expression of a very good attitude to take when you hear new teachings, things which may be not entirely apparent on the surface. It's certainly clear that what he's teaching is nothing. He's not teaching anything wrong. He's certainly teaching things which are in many ways the same as Buddhism, not to do evil actions by body, by speech, and by wrong intention, and by not to have a bad livelihood. Obviously, it's a good teaching that he has there, and yet he's not entirely sure whether he can agree with it completely. And so he's in this kind of poised space where he's not immediately coming to a quick decision about it. Neither rejoicing nor rejecting. Then, without thinking, without doing either, he rose from his seat and went away thinking, I shall learn the meaning of this statement in the presence of the Blessed One. Then he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and reported to the Blessed One his entire conversation with the wanderer Ugahamana. Okay, so now this is a bit of an idiom here. So what he Bhikkhubodhi has translated literally what the Pali says in this particular case. So with the wanderer Ugahamana, Samanamandikaputta, studying together with him the discussion, Katha Salapo, and that all to the Blessed One he declared. Okay? So you can easily imagine in many other cases in the suttas you find when that happens that they actually repeat what was said. Right? Here he merely says he repeated what he said. But in many places it actually has the text, it has the full text, and maybe then abbreviates that full text. So you can imagine this is a literary form that's used here. Perhaps there might be some versions of the sutta that actually repeat that whole discussion in detail. But this one, it just says that he repeated it. And then the Blessed One said, if that was so, carpenter, then a young tender infant lying prone is accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic invincible attained to the supreme attainment, according to the wanderer Ugahamana's statement. For a young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion body. So how could he do an evil bodily action beyond mere wriggling? A young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion of speech. So how could he utter evil speech beyond mere whining? A young tender infant, lying prone does not even have the notion intention. So how could he have evil intentions beyond mere sulking? A young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion livelihood. So how could he make his living by evil livelihood beyond being suckled at his mother's breast? If that were so, Carpenter, then a young, tender infant lying prone is accomplished in what is wholesome according to the Wanderer Ugahamana's statement. So, here the Buddha, obviously not too impressed with the Wanderer's statement. Just a few notes here. The phrase, the young, tender infant, Daharo Kumaro Mando, lying prone, Utana Seyako, and just to notice the use of the word Kumaro, and for those of us who have been looking at the Bhikkhuni Vinaya, we have the word Kumari Bhuta, and as I've been saying, that this is one of the words for the Sikkhamana, that the Sikkhamana training needs to be given to a Kumari Bhuta, and so here this is showing obviously one of the meanings of Kumari or Kumara. Obviously meaning a boy or a girl here. It's not meaning a grown man or woman. And he's obviously taking the mickey out of for Samana Mandika a little bit. The word.
I was a little bit shocked when, it's the first time I've come across this.
Yeah.
It's a little bit startled. It's sort of, you know, when I finish reading the text, it's kind of, oh, okay, you know. When you look at the, you know, he said, the bodily actions, the speech, livelihood, obviously the sila component of the
Nathalaya
Kalpa, plus he put the knowing intentions, which is incorporating part of the wisdom content of the Nathalaya Kalpa, in the light of evil being the non-evil and the non-cruelty. Not necessarily okay, you have to include the renunciation component.
Right.
But it seemed a bit
harsh, you reckon?
But you know, it's certainly more fleshed out. But just initially on the first part, I must say I had to stop and take another breath and I was a little bit uncertain. Anyway, that was just my first pass on it.
Yeah, really good.
The claims he makes about those four things, those you know, the top, invisible attainments.
And it also seems to me that the also part of it is simply that accomplishing those things doesn't just mean the negative form of it. So it's not just refraining from wrong speech, but also knowing how to use right speech. So this is what the infant really can't do. It doesn't know how. You know, both obviously there are things missing. You know, the factors missing, but also that even those factors, it's just purely just as a restraint. And as you know, we've seen so many times in the suttas that when they're actually described, it actually says, you know, for example, right speech. You know, using speech at the right time, speaking about Dhamma and Vinaya and so on. So, but this is that's an important point. And I think that again, it's something that the Buddhism tends to fall into, is this kind of a purely negative description of things, and say that accomplishing right speech is simply not lying or something like that. And so this is one of those texts which shows that kind of thinking is not adequate or you know, doesn't really represent what the Buddha was talking about.
It's also really good in using that, because he doesn't mean that
you
are passive.
Right, yeah.
And which is, I mean, so often Buddhists are accused of being passive because they often are.
Because they often are.
They sort of fall back into the excuse or
You don't say anything, yeah.
Harsh.
And it happens a lot. No doubt about it. So here's the word for wriggling is pandita. Pandita mata, mere wriggling. And then the crying, or whining, rodita mata. It's probably crying rather than whining, really. Roti tamata. Having a wrong intention or something, sulking, vikujita, mere sulking. That's a very unusual word, vikujita. I don't know if it occurs elsewhere. And then the how could they make their livelihood except at the mother's breast is the madu tanya, mother's breast. So when a man possesses four qualities, Carpenter, I describe him not as accomplishing what is wholesome or perfecting what is wholesome or an ascetic invincible attained to the supreme attainment, but as one who stands in the same category as the young tender infant lying prone. What for? Does no evil intentions, no evil speech, no evil bodily actions, no evil speech, no evil intentions, does not make his living by any evil livelihood. So it may be relevant to that to just have a quick look at the Chinese here. Okay, so there's a slight difference between the Pali and the Chinese in that respect. So in the Pali version, the Buddha just basically rejects the entire statement. He's not accomplished in, you know, what is wholesome and so on, nor supreme occludes. But the Majjhima Agama version has a finer distinction at this point, according to Venerable Nalio, since according to its report, the Buddha acknowledged that one who avoids evil by way of body, speech, thought and livelihood is accomplished in what is wholesome, even though such a one has not yet become a supreme recluse. All right, so here's the difference. Is the Chinese one made like an analytical statement. It said that if you avoid evil by body, speech, mind and livelihood, then you are accomplishing the kusala, but you're still not a supreme recluse. Mm-hmm. So this is a more nuanced way of depicting it. So you could look at it either way. You could say, well, yeah, that's more of a way, and Nalio finds that's more convincing because in this way the value of avoiding evil action is given proper place, where the same is somewhat lost if out of sight, with the Pali version's sweeping dismissal. So that's one way of looking at it. Or you could also say that even the mere avoidance of those things is a good thing in itself, but is not enough to be called accomplished in what is wholesome. I mean, normally, surely, I would think if you say, you know, when you reply, is to say you're accomplished in what is wholesome. You know, for example, at the very minimum, you'd have to actually understand what is wholesome. I mean, it's not merely happening to not do something that's unwholesome. Then if that was the case, then the trees would be accomplished in what is wholesome as well. You know, you have to understand what's right and wrong and to actually deliberately avoid it. And this is an example of what Ken Wilber calls the pre-trans fallacy, that someone who's at a very basic stage, like a baby, can avoid doing evil actions. And in some ways that's similar to somebody who's a very advanced practitioner who also avoids evil actions, but it's not really the same. It just looks like it's the same. Obviously it's a quite different kind of thing. There's no ethical content to the baby's actions. It's merely incapable of doing evil. Okay, so I didn't notice that before. Analo actually has a note on the different numbers. According to the PTS edition, has 300, while the Burmese and Siamese editions have 500, and even one Sinhalese edition even has 700. Crikey. Okay, so best take the numbers given with a bit of a grain of salt. Okay, so next one, the Pali goes on. When a man is possesses 10 qualities, Carpenter, I describe him as accomplishing what is wholesome, perfected is what is wholesome, and ascetic, invincible, attained to the supreme attainment. But first of all, I say it must be understood thus. Yeah, so now, interesting, notice how Bhikkhu Bodhi's put a little phrase here in square brackets is inserted in the text, and that kind of as a bridging between this little phrase and that phrase. Now if you look in the Pali here, that bridging bracketed phrase of course doesn't occur at all, and the I say it must be understood thus is actually at the end of this sentence, not at the beginning, as Bhikkhu Bodhi's put it. So if you translate it literally from the Pali, it's a carpenter endowed with 10 factors, describe a person as accomplished in what is wholesome, skilled in what is wholesome, attained to the highest attainment, and a summoner invincible. There are these unwholesome sealers. Okay, these, I say, carpenter, should be understood. Okay, in other words, it's going quite abruptly from this statement on the summoner invincible to this discussion of the wholesome sealers and intentions. Now, the interesting thing here, and then this point about the 10 qualities isn't actually discussed further until right at the end of the Pali discourse. In the Chinese version, that passage here is absent. Okay, so that passage, the discussion on the 10 qualities, only appears at the end of the discourse. So in this case, the Chinese one is probably more convincing, because you've just got the introduction of the 10 qualities and then it's left for several pages and you only come back to it right at the end. So probably just an editorial slip up there in the Pali text. Okay, so then the text goes on to discuss these are unwholesome habits, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's chosen to translate sila in this case as habits. It's a somewhat problematic translation. But normally he translates sila as virtue, so probably because it's difficult to talk about unwholesome virtues. But if you translated sila as ethics, you perhaps wouldn't have the same problem. Okay, these are unwholesome, so I'll just keep it at sealers, just to keep it clear. So it discusses wholesome and unwholesome sealers and so on, and then intentions. Now notice that this is basically covering the same ground that we've had before, the intentions being the sankhapa, and the four grounds which Samana Mandika mentioned were avoiding unwholesome acts of body, speech, and livelihood, which all comes under the sealers, and then also the intention, the sankhapa. So it's a slightly different categorization, but it's talking about the same thing which Samana Mandika was talking about. But what it is mentioning, again, is not just refraining from doing bad things, but also, as I mentioned just a little bit earlier, the importance of understanding these things. Okay, so it's emphasizing not merely good behavior, but actually understanding. These are akusala sila. Okay, these are akusala sila. Akusala is unskillful sila, ethics. Akusala sila, cease without remainder here. One practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of akusala sila. And I say this must be understood this. These are wholesome sila. Wholesome silas originate from this. Wholesome silas cease without remainder here. And one practicing this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome silas. And then the same pattern with intentions. And of course this is analysing each of them in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Must be understood thus. These are unwholesome intentions, akusala sankapa. Unwholesome intentions originate from this, unwholesome intentions cease from remainder here. One practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions. And it must be understood these are wholesome intentions originate from this, wholesome intentions cease without remainder here. And thus one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions. Okay, so obviously the introduction of the idea that one practices for the ending of wholesome, skillful sealers and intentions is... let's see what we're talking about here. Certainly something which is, I guess, characteristic of the transcendental dimension of Buddhism. And not necessarily found in all religions. If you went to the mosque or something like that and talked to them, this is how we practice for the ending of wholesome conduct, they'd probably think you're a bit strange.
Practice to end our attachment
Yeah. So, what are, okay, what are, so starting with, what is unwholesome sealers? Blah, 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 where are we now? Okay, what are unwholesome sealers? Their origin is stated. So what are unwholesome sealers? They're unwholesome bodily actions, verbal actions, and evil livelihood. Okay, akusa kaya kama, akusa vachi kama, and papako ajivo. Alright, so these are the unwholesome sealers. Now, this is of course the same group that we found earlier, bodily acts, focus of speech, and livelihood, and also the three sealer factors of the Eightfold Path. Just as a terminological thing, notice here the usage of papa, papaka ajiva, papa meaning usually translated as evil, although that's a bit strong, probably bad would simply be better. And here is the same as akusala. So akusala kaya kama, akusala vachi kama, and papaka ajiva. So they're put on the same level. That's not always the case, and in fact this particular sutta is a bit ambiguous in that sense. You actually have two sets of terms, papa and two sets of terms dealing with, I have actually quite a few, but two main sets of terms dealing with moral acts in Buddhism. One pair is papa and punya, which are probably best just to translate bad and good. They often translate evil and meritorious, but evil is far too strong for papa. And then kusala, akusala, and the literal meaning of kusala, of course, meaning skillful. And you have it very commonly in the Mahayana traditions, of course, as skillful means, upaya kushala. So meaning skillful, often translated as wholesome. And in this sutta we have here, then they're treated basically the same. Papa and kusala are treated on the same level. There is a kind of a subtle difference in how they tend to be used, in that papa and punya are a bit more worldly, whereas kusala and akusala are related more specifically to Buddhist teachings. Papa and punya is more like conventional worldly good and bad, and kusala and akusala is more skillful according to the higher values of the Buddhist path. And in particular, an arahant can be said to act in a way which is kusala, but an arahant doesn't do what is punya. This kind of distinction actually comes up in some other respects in the interpretation of this sutta, so that's why I mention it here. But just to notice those two different ways of talking about good and bad. So here, bad sila is bad actions by body, speech, and wrong livelihood. Okay, where do these unwholesome habits, these akusala silas, originate from? Their origin is stated. They originate from mind, citta samuttana. Okay, they originate from mind. The what mind? The mind is multiple, bahun, aneka vidhang, of countless sorts. Nana pakarana, of many, many different aspects. Okay, there is mind affected by lust, desire, lust, hatred, and delusion. Saragan, sadosan, samohan. The originator from here is unwholesome sealants, akusala sealants. Okay, so, and where do these akusala sealants cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated. Here, a bhikkhu abandons bodily misconduct and develops good bodily conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops good verbal conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops good mental conduct. He abandons wrong livelihood and gains a living by right livelihood. It is here that unwholesome habits, akusala sila, cease without remainder. So here we have one of those aspects which we mentioned earlier about the development of sila, that it's not merely about abandoning what's wrong, but also about developing what's good. Okay? So abandons the wrong conduct of speech and develops the good conduct of speech. Okay, so here the unwholesome sealers cease without remainder. And how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome sealers? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal for the non-arising of unarisen evil unwholesome state. Unwholesome dhammas, and he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. He awakens zeal for the abandoning of evil arisen evil unwholesome dhammas. He awakens zeal for the arising of unarisen wholesome dhammas, and he awakens zeal for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome dhammas. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. One so practicing practices the way to the cessation of unwholesome dhammas. Okay, so this is the standard formula for the four right efforts. So in other words, he's making an effort to do these things. And again, this is, I think, the insertion of the right efforts here is why is the right efforts specifically mentioned here? Quite possibly to contrast with the very passive image of the baby lying prone in the opening passage. And so there's actually an effort that needs to be made. So it's interesting that so far, if we compare the statement by Samanamandikaputta and the statements by the Buddha, we've already seen a number of, he's taken that basic statement, he's already drawn that out in many different aspects. And first of all, he's now said, it's the energy that you put into it, which is important. He said it's developing the positive side of something, not just the negative abandoning of it, which is important. He said it's developing the understanding of it, which is important. Yeah. Not just doing it mindlessly, and we'll see later on at the end of it, another thing that's important is the bringing in of other factors apart from these ones which are mentioned here. So now come on to one of the most interesting parts of the sutta, the kusala sila, skillful ethics. What is skillful ethics? They're wholesome, skillful bodily actions, verbal actions, and purification of livelihood. Okay, ajiva parisudhihampi. These are called kusala sila. Where do these kusala silas originate from? They originate from mind, citta smutana. Mind is various of many sorts and different kinds. But there is a mind without lust, without hate, without delusion. Kusala silas arise from there. And where do these kusala silas cease without remainder? Here, bhikkhu. Oops. Okay, so here, there's cessation of state. Here, bhikkhu is virtuous, but he does not identify with his virtue. And he understands as it actually is that deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom where these wholesome habits, these kusala silas, cease without remainder. So this is an interesting little passage et. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation there is does not identify with his virtue, is an interpretive translation. The actual Pali says, here, carpenter, a bhikkhu is virtuous, silavahoti, no cha silamayo, literally means not made of sila, not formed of sila, what it literally says. So I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's, this ending, maya ending, is used in some places. It's actually in one of the Ajahn Buddhadasa's favourite sayings was atamayata, was his favourite words, atamayata, which literally means not made of that, which again means has an idea of identification, non-identification with things. So I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is correct here, but just to note that certainly not obvious from the Pali itself what that is actually meant there. It's not an entirely transparent term there. So by not identifying with sila, then one understands the cheto vimuti, panya vimuti, yathabhutam padanati. Usually, of course, cheto vimuti, panya vimuti, in that kind of phrase always means arahantship, where these kusala silas cease without remainder. Okay? So it's pointing to the fact that kusala sila, skillful ethics, cease in arahantship, or perhaps in perhaps in Nibbana or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's have a look at the Chinese version. So the bit about the liberation of mind and liberation through wisdom, where wholesome conduct ceases completely, is not found in the Chinese version. Okay? So you just come back to that, and we'll just read it as if we were reading the Chinese version. Where do kusala silas, where do skillful ethics cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated here. A bhikkhu is virtuous, but he does not identify with his virtue. Okay? That would be the end of that in the Chinese version.
Finished the job, it's not the pursuit of any actions arising in this world. It's all met by default position. That's basically, I think, this is driving it.
Well,
why they must use good speech? Because for them it's impossible to use.
Yeah. Possibly, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. It's not entirely clear. I mean, another aspect is, of course, the arahant, in the sense if it's understood in the sense of punya and papa, then the arahant's not doing karma, which is leading to rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty straightforward. It's not clear whether it actually means an arahant here. The Pali obviously means an arahant, but then the Chinese doesn't have those phrases which are specifically referring to arahantship. So perhaps the Chinese is a bit more open to interpretation here. It's possible that even that the phrase was put into the Pali precisely to clear up that ambiguity. Yeah, that whole bit is not mentioned in the Chinese. No. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that's quite a standard teaching in the Pali as well. You know, you have the karma which is neither black nor white, that leads to the ending of karma. Yeah. So,
what's the Chinese version?
Chinese version says, where do these kusala silas cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated. Here, a bhikkhu is virtuous, but he does not identify his virtue. What do you mean it's on the right hand side? No. That's the Pali. Yeah. This is the translation. Do you want to look at the Chinese? We don't have a translation. No. We can pull it up if you want, but it'll probably just say the same thing as Analia said. Okay, let's have a bit of a look, keep on looking through, and then we'll see if there's any. Okay. Oh, that's just an interesting point. The rest of the sutta is pretty straightforward, but that one's quite interesting. Yeah. Okay, unwholesome intentions. Their intention of sensual desire, of ill will, of cruelty. These are unwholesome intentions. Where do these unwholesome intentions originate from? They originate from perception. Okay, so the silas originated from mind, from citta. And now these sanyasamuttana. What perception? A perception is multiple, varied, and of different aspects. There is perception of sensual desire, perception of ill will, perception of cruelty. So these same perceptions, interestingly, as the sankhapa, but perception lying prior in the cognitive process before your intentions or thoughts. Where do these unwholesome intentions cease without remainder? So then it's another interesting bit. It comes here, the cessation is stated here. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, vitaka vichara, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. It is here that unwholesome intentions cease without remainder. Okay, so... I'll just read through this a little bit, and we'll just come back to the interpretation here. How does practicing, does he practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome sankhapa, akusala sankhapa? And again, the four right efforts mentioned here. Oh, I should mention that where the Pali has the four right efforts, the Chinese has the four satipatthanas in both of these cases, both the intentions and the silas. So that's quite a significant difference. What are the wholesome intentions? They are intention. Okay, so break things. Wholesome intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will, intention of non-cruelty. Nekama sankappa, avyabhada sankappa, avihingsa sankappa. These are called wholesome intentions. Where do they originate from? They originate from perception. Perception is many and fold and varied, but there is a perception of renunciation, of non-ill will, and of non-cruelty from these that wholesome intentions arise. And where do they end? So where do they cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated here with the stilling of vitaka vichara. A bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained forward, initial and sustained application, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. It is here that these wholesome intentions cease without remainder. And how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal and so on, developing the four right efforts. So here there's quite an interesting correlation in the practice of sealers, that one is said to have ended, seems a bit more straightforward, that one ends unwholesome acts by developing the corresponding wholesome acts, and one ends the wholesome acts by non-identification with them. Possibly meaning arahantship, possibly not. But here, one's relationship to intention is based on the attainment of certain states of samadhi, so that the unwholesome intentions are abandoned with first jhana, and the wholesome intentions abandoned with second jhana. One of the keys to understanding this is that the word we're translating as intention, or sankappa, is usually in the suttas identical with or synonymous with the word vitaka. Okay, so the words vitaka and sankappa often have the same meaning, which in everyday context just means thought. Okay, so if you translate them both as thought, then you can see, try and kind of see what the text is getting at. Of course, you have the usual interpretive problem with the jhanas, is that the first jhana is still with vitaka vichara. Savitakan savichara. And yet, in many places, or several places, it's suggested that the, or strongly implied that the first jhana is without any kind of thought, or without an active mind. It's supposed to be a mind of oneness and stillness. So my understanding of that is that the first jhana, the words vitaka vichara, as with all the words in the first jhana, have a much more subtle, more refined meaning than they have in everyday language. And so I translate vitaka vichara in the context of jhana as initial and sustained application of mind rather than thought and consideration or whatever. Bhikkhu Bodhi has applied and sustained thought. Still doesn't entirely clear up the interpretive question here. This is to say, is unwholesome sankappa really only ended in the first jhana? That would seem to be a bit extreme, perhaps. In everyday life, we can end unwholesome thoughts just by developing wholesome thoughts. The sankappa, sama sankappa, is only the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a long way before the development of wholesome, of jhana as the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. And indeed, in various suttas, especially the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha talks about how he abandoned unwholesome thoughts and developed wholesome thoughts, and could continue just thinking in a wholesome way continually, without having akusala sankappa, akusala thoughts, then proceeded to go on and then develop jhanas for the sake of abandoning those wholesome thoughts, because they wouldn't lead to peace of mind by themselves. So there seems to be a bit of ambiguity in the text here, and they're not necessarily 100% making sense, as far, at least on a surface level. why unwholesome thoughts are only bound with first jhana, and then why it's only with the second jhana that kusala sankalpa is abandoned. But remembering that the word is not intention, the word is sankappa, which is usually a synonym of vitaka. So when it's saying that the vitaka, the wholesome sankappa ends, it seems to be saying that the vitaka ends as well. This is more or less a synonym. So I'd just be careful of reading too much into it. It seems to me to be by saying that kusala sankappa ends in the second jhana, it's just the same thing as saying kusala. It's the same that the vitaka vichara ends in the second jhana. So the interpretation of this in the now both the Pali and the Chinese versions say that the unwholesome intentions or thoughts cease with the first jhana. When it comes to the cessation of wholesome thoughts or intentions, the two versions however disagree. The Pali account attributes such cessation to the second jhana, its Chinese parallel speaks of the fourth jhana instead. Okay, so the Chinese says that the wholesome intention ceases in fourth jhana. Okay, so here the Pali, as Analia says, seems to be make more sense. That there's the vitaka vichara is usually said to end in the second jhana. So the interaction of fourth jhana seems a bit arbitrary there. It's worth bringing up here the controversial points in this particular sutta is the question of the commentarial interpretation of these states. Okay, so according to the Pali commentaries, the cessation of unwholesome conduct takes place with stream entry, and the cessation of wholesome conduct with full liberation. Okay, so when we read the cessation of a kusala sila came with the development of kusala sila, the commentary interprets that as stream entry, and similarly the commentary interprets the cessation of wholesome sila with full liberation, with arahantship, and as we saw that's suggested in the Pali text, but more clearly so than in the Chinese text. Similarly, the cessation of unwholesome intentions takes place with non-returning, just as the cessation of wholesome intentions, kusala sankappa, comes with the attainment of arahantship. Okay? So now this then becomes a somewhat curious interpretation, because the sutta is equating these things with a jhana attainment, and the commentary says that this is the arahantship. Now this commentarial explanation appears to rest on a too literal interpretation of the expression cease without remainder, aparisesa nirujhanti. A perusal of other instances of the same expression in the discourses indicates that to cease without remainder does not necessarily refer to the final eradication achieved through the different stages of realization. The same expression occurs, for example, when describing how certain types of perceptions cease without remainder by attaining the sphere of nothingness, or how unwholesome thoughts cease without remainder when one is well established in mindfulness. Okay, so that's a very important point to understand. According to the sutta idiom, that the phrase cease without remainder does not necessarily mean complete, permanent, final eradication of things. It's just an idiom to mean that they're gone. Which may be for the time being, or it may refer to they've gone completely, but it doesn't necessarily refer to that. Okay, so this is one problem. Now, the other thing which the commentaries based on, and the commentarial problem is based on, is the concept of lokuttara jhana. And so they interpret the jhanas which are there as being lokuttara jhana. So we just hear about these jhanas and the cessation of these various things. The commentary says that they're the lokuttara jhanas which are attained at the moment of realizing the path. So to understand that, I'll just explain in brief about the notion of lokuttara jhana as developed in the Abhidhamma. Okay, so here we have the Abhidhamma book, the Vibhanga. And this is the list, the table of contents for the Vibhanga. And you can see that the table of contents presents a very familiar list of dhammas, the khandhas, ayatanas, dhatus, saccha, indriya, paticca-samuppada, satipatthana, and so on. And these, of course, being the main topics of the Sanyutta Nikaya. So this being an example of what I call the Sanyutta Matika. Now, the topic of the differentiation between Lokuttara Jhana and Lokiya Jhana, worldly samadhi or jhana, is fundamental to the Theravadan Abhidhamma and is found repeatedly through all of the major texts in the Pali Abhidhamma. It's not found in the same sense in other Abhidhamma systems, although there are some comparable developments. So I'll just have a look at that in a minute. So we'll just go on and have a look at one example of what this Lokuttara Jhana is and how it's developed and so on in the Vibhanga. So this is the Vibhanga chapter, the list of table of contents, and we'll look at the Jhana Vibhanga. Here's the table of contents for the Jhana Vibhanga, and notice the three different sections: Suttanta Bhajaniya, Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, and Panha Puchaka. So Suttanta Bhajaniya means the description or the analysis according to the suttas. Abhidhamma Bhajaniya is the analysis according to the Abhidhamma, and the Panha Puchaka means the question and answer section. Okay, so that's basically a series of questions and answers on different details of the analysis. So if we look at the Suttanta Bhajaniya, and right from the beginning of the Suttanta Bhajaniya, and remember this is called the Jhana Vibhanga, the analysis of jhana. Now the actual analysis of jhana that it presents is actually quite detailed. It actually gives the whole of the gradual training. So this is one place where the whole gradual training appears within the Abhidhamma. Here a bhikkhu is restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, is endowed with conduct and resort and seeing fear and the slightest faults. He undertakes the training precepts and is restrained in his sense faculties, is moderate in eating, is devoted to wakefulness in the different parts of the night, and so on. So these are all the standard teachings on the gradual training, and it then goes on to discuss these, clear comprehension when going and returning and so on, resorting to a secluded place for meditation, abandoning the five hindrances, and then finally developing the four jhanas. So this is a summary of the basic gradual training, which is the basic text which the Abhidhamma system is then commenting on. Remembering this is the Suttanta Bhajaniya, analysis according to the suttas. And that's exactly what it is. It's just quoting a passage from the suttas and then giving an analysis of it. Just skimming down here to the passage where it's talking about the actual jhanas themselves. Okay, so here it's talking about the analysis of the jhanas. It says, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, and then it goes on Abhidhamma style to say, well then what is the sensual pleasures, what's the karma? Desire, chanda is karma, raga, passion is karma, chanda, raga, desire and passion is karma, sankappo is karma. So here sankappo is a synonym for chanda. Intention is, and so on, so it's just giving different synonyms for karma. What akusala dhamma is the unwholesome dhammas is the in sensual displeasure, ill will, sloth and torpor, and so on, so the five precepts. And then goes on to say, what is vitaka and vichara? What is vitaka? Okay, so this is again one of those questions that we very often discuss, and so it's interesting to see what the Abhidhamma definition here. What is vitaka in the context of jhana? Yotako is just vitaka without the V. Sankappo, and so as I mentioned before, sankappa is very, is usually used as a synonym for vitaka, as mentioned in the Abhidhamma here. Appanna, now these words now are then becoming much more technical. These are all words found commonly in the suttas, and ordinary everyday language terms. These ones are not, they may occur from time to time in the suttas, they're certainly not normal sutta passage, sutta words. Appanna, I think it means something like application. I'm not 100% sure, that's just another form of it. Chetiso abhinirupana, and again, this is quite a technical term. Chetiso abhinirupana, applying of the mind or putting of the mind, something like that. And sama sankappa, right sankappa. And what's vichara? Yo charo, vicharo, anu vicharo, upa vicharo. So these are basically just set of synonyms. And then chittasa anusandhanata, anubekhanata. So this is perhaps the most interesting or useful part of this Abhidhamma definition. The word anusandhanata literally means the continual or sustained application or connection. Sandha or sandhi is a word for connection. Okay, so when you, for example, you connect two parts of a word together, the way that you connect it is called sandhi. It's a linguistic term. So anusandhanata is the sustained connection of the mind. The prefix anu has the idea of sustained. And anupekhanata has the pekha is to means to observe something, to watch something. So anupekhanata is the sustained or continual watching. Okay, so this is the Abhidhamma definition of vichara. So this is, I think, quite a good justification for the rendering of vichara in the context of jhana as being sustained application. Okay, probably where Nyanamoli originally came up with that rendering. So it's quite literally what the Pali means here. So it's just giving you an idea of how the Abhidhamma Vibhanga goes about its work. Okay, it's taken a passage from the suttas and then goes and analyzes the different terms here. Okay, so that's the Suttanta Bhajaniya. Now if you have a look at the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, we have it's divided into different sections, Rupa Vachara, Arupa Vachara and Lokuttara. Rupa and Arupa, of course, referring to the form jhanas and formless jhanas, and Lokuttara being referring to the planes of attainment. So looking at the Rupa Vachara, these four jhanas, the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Right, what is the first jhana? Here, Bhikkhu, yasmin samaye rupu pupatiya magang bhaveti vivecheva kamehi, and then it has the jhana formula, which is abbreviated, vivecho kusalehi damehi savitakan savicharam viveka jankiti sukhang vatamang jhanan upasampadja viharati. So we've still got a quote here from here. This bit here is a quote from the suttas, right? But we've added these bits at the beginning, ida bhikkhave yasmin samaye rupa pupatiya magang bhaveti. On that occasion, yasming samaye, so this is a constant feature of the Abhidhamma literature. In the suttas you always say on one occasion, ekang samayam, and the Abhidhamma you say yasming samaye, on whatever occasion. Okay, so it's not a contextual, it's a decontextualized teaching. It's not on a particular occasion the Buddha was staying somewhere and taught this to a particular person or group of people. It's saying on whatever occasion. It's an abstract or generalized teaching. Rupu bhavatiya magang bhaveti. One develops the path for rebirth in the form realms. Okay? This is what this phrase means. And and then it goes on to quote the formula from the first jhana from the suttas. Then it says, Patavi Kasina, the earth Kasina. On that occasion, the jhana is of five factors, Vitaka, Vichara, Piti, Sukha, Chittase, Kagata. This is called the first jhana. Other dhammas are associated with the jhana. Okay, jhana sampayutta. What that means is that there are certain mental factors which are present in the first jhana, which are not included in the five basic jhana factors, and these are called associated jhana sampayutta, associated mental factors. Elsewhere in the Abhidhamma, these are all listed. So this is the Abhidhamma analysis of jhana, according to the Rupa Vachara, the domain of the form realms. So a number of things have happened here. Okay. The most important one is that we have this idea that one is developing the jhana for the sake of rebirth in the form realms. And this is the phrasing that is used here is exactly the same as the phrasing that's used when the Buddha rejected his early teachers. And he said that I'm not going to practice this dhamma because it only leads to rebirth in the realm of nothingness or in the realm of neither perception or non-perception. Okay, and so here is the same thing. It's a path for reappearance in the form realm. So what it's saying here is that this kind of jhana is a jhana which is developed presumably by people outside of Buddhism in order to get reborn in the Brahma realms. Okay, this is what's being referred to here. It also introduces the idea of Patavikasina, the earth kasina, and here, as in the suttas, the Patavikasina clearly refers to a state of samadhi and not to a meditation device. So this is one thing. Let's go and have a look at the Lokuttara.
Okay.
Yeah?
So what we've just looked at there is two different sections of the Abhidhamma, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't actually come across the Rupa or haven't been in to the Rupa. So we've looked at two different parts or chapters, sections of the Abhidhamma, and
Right. And we're just about to look at the... Just about to look at the third. Just to go back over, just show you the course that we've come on. We've looked at the Vibhanga, one of the seven books of the Abhidhamma. Chapter of contents, one of the chapters here, the Jhana Vibhanga, we've looked at. It has these two sections. We briefly looked at the first section, Suttanta Vajaniya, which has this the word analysis according to the suttas. And then we're looking now at the Abhidhamma Vajaniya, the second part. And we're looking primarily at this section here, Rupavachara. The domain of the form realm, and we're about to look at the Lokuttara, translated as transcendental aspect. Yasming is a relative pronoun, and Tasming is a demonstrative pronoun. So Tasming means on that occasion, Yasming means on whatever occasion. It's actually cognate with the English, the difference between WH at the beginning of the words and the at the beginning of the words. So the difference between what and that and where and there or and so on. The basic idea is it's a generalized statement. Okay, so here now we're talking about the development of the Lokuttara jhana. Now remember that the point of doing all this is because the commentary to our sutta has effectively said that the jhana which is talked about in the Samana Mandika Sutta is a Lokuttara jhana. Okay? And by doing so, it's relying on the terminology and the ideas which are developed at its earliest stage here in the Pali Abhidhamma. And so we'll read how the Pali Abhidhamma presents the notion of Lokuttara jhana. And I'll explain what the words mean and so on in a minute, but we'll just have a look at the text to start with. Now, on that occasion, what is the first jhana? Here, a bhikkhu, on whatever occasion, Lokuttarang jhanang bhaveti, one develops the Lokuttara jhana, niyanikang, which means leading out, apachaya gaming, is leading to dispersal. Literally, i.e. it's not leading to the amassing of karma, but leading to the dispersal of karma. Dittigatanang pahanaya, for the abandoning of wrong views. Okay, patamaya bhumiya, on the pertaining to the attainment of the first plane. Patamaya bhumiya patiya, or for the attainment of the first plane. Probably means for the attainment of the first plane. The first plane here, Patama Bhumi, of course, meaning stream entry. Vivicheva Kamehi, and then has the jhana formula, as always. So notice how central, completely central, the whole jhana formula is to all of these things. You know, here we are in the Abhidhamma, and the jhana formula is being quoted again and again and again and again and again, constantly throughout all these things. Now, just as the previous one talking about the jhana for attaining rebirth in the Brahma realm, then added this bit at the end, it mentioned the Patavikasena. Here it mentions the Dukkha Patipadam Dandaha Binyang, with a painful way of practice and a sluggish direct knowledge. All right. On that occasion, there are five jhana factors: vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. This is the first jhana. All the other dhammas are associated with the jhana, and it goes through the other jhanas and so on. Now, this bit where it mentions the dukkha paripada danda binya, that's not very important. All that's doing is that's introducing another set of variations in it, which is what the Abhidhamma loves to do. So previously, when it introduced the earth kasina in that particular case, then of course it would then go on to repeat exactly the same thing with the water kasina, the fire kasina, the air kasina, and so on. It's just delighting in finding ways of multiplying these things out to endless variations. So this is a category which is found in the suttas, that there's a practice which is painful, a practice which is pleasant, a practice which is swift, a practice which is slow, and so on. And so when you see that there, it's just introducing it, and then it will later go on to work it through all of the different variations of those things. Okay, so it's not really essential to the definition as such.
The formula of how to attain jhana, or the formula of just describing what it is.
Although in the
But it uses the same one, even though it's the previous one.
The description is exactly the same.
Reminds me of bureaucratic documents.
I think I learned a thing or two from the Abhidhamma. But that point you made about the way to attain jhanas is actually what's mentioned in the Suttanta Bhajaniya, which we saw at the beginning, where it's got the gradual training. So that's giving you the way to attain it. But then this one is in the Abhidhamma, is purely concerned with the actual the mind and the states which are in the mind at that particular occasion. Yeah, this is what it's concerned to analyse. And you know, when you look at how central the jhana formula is to the entire Abhidhamma analysis, actually that Abhidhamma formula is probably the earliest or most fundamental statement by the Buddha or in the Buddhist tradition on the nature of the mind. It's actually, I think, underlies that whole development in Abhidhamma of developing what actual states of consciousness, what states are present in consciousness at that time. And the Buddha was concerned to define what are these mental states present in these various states of samadhi, because that's what you're supposed to be practicing. So he was very concerned to define that. And then from there, that was taken and generalized to apply to all other forms of consciousness. There are other precedents in the suttas for this kind of Abhidhamma analysis, but certainly the formula of the jhanas is one of the most, if not the most, important of all of them.
So when
they usually call Lokiya, although we didn't actually find that word here in the Abhidhamma text. Yeah, Lokiya.
The formula is the same in each description of the paragraph.
Yeah.
Does the words Lokutra and Arupa and Rupa define the result rather than. So it's not.
Exactly.
The description, it's not still
what's
happening at the time.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly the point, and that's exactly what I was going to talk about right next. Is that the state of mind is exactly the same, but what's different is the result of it. So in the Rupa Vachara Samadhi, you're developing it in order to get rebirth in the Brahma realms. Okay, in this one, you're developing it in order to lead out to for dispersal, for abandoning of wrong views and so on. In other words, for attaining of stream entry, and of course it goes through and we'll develop that for each of the other stages of attainment as well. So the description, the difference of the description is not in the actual state, it's in what is the purpose of that, what's the outcome of that state. Are you practicing that jhana in order to get reborn in the Brahma realms, or are you practicing it in order to realise enlightenment? Okay? So this just...
Do you have any control?
Well, that's a good point. Practically speaking, I think it's probably a slightly artificial distinction. Yeah. But... Yeah, I mean it is. It's your intention and level of wisdom and all of that kind of thing. Yeah,
so it's,
In the actual state itself. Yeah. That's right. According to this. And what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Just that comes back to the nature of the word Lokuttara, which I asked about earlier, but I just put it off till now. It's a bit ambiguous. It's used in two ways. Loka means the world. Uttara means beyond. Okay? So Lokuttara, beyond the world. Okay? But it can have two senses. Now, in the suttas, when Lokuttara is used, it seems to be used in a sense of pertaining to or about that which leads beyond the world. Okay? So, for example, you have a description of the suttas. The Buddha says you shouldn't study those trivial suttas which are dealing with worldly things, but you should study those profound suttas which are Lokuttara, okay, and dealing with emptiness. Right? So clearly when it's talking about the suttas as being Lokuttara, it doesn't mean that the suttas are some kind of transcendental thing, right? But it means that they're giving teachings which lead you to transcendence. They're pointing you to the path beyond the world. Yeah? So it seems to me that's how the word Lokuttara is used in the suttas itself. However, in the Abhidhamma later period, the word Lokuttara came to mean actually those things which are associated with those factors which are pertaining directly to the paths and the fruits and to Nibbana. They have a list, they call the nine Lokuttara Dhammas, the nine transcendental states, which are the path and fruit of stream entry, the path and fruit of once return, path and fruit of non-return, path and fruit of arahatship, and Nibbana is the ninth. So this is a standard doctrinal set which you'll hear referred to in Theravada. You'll find it in various chants and all kinds of things in Theravada scriptures. So this idea that Lokuttara means actually pertaining to that time of awakening. Now notice here that there's no suggestion that there's any difference in the state of mind between one who's developing the Rupavachara Samadhi and one who's developing the Lokuttara Samadhi, nor is there any suggestion that there's any difference in time involved. And this is a very important point. One's simply developing the jhana and one doing samaye, on which occasion you're developing, and one develops it, one makes more of it. Okay. And so the whole language, the way that it's used here, one enters upasampadja viharati, one abides in that jhana. And so all the language is exactly the same as the sutta language. It's clearly referring to a state of consciousness which you enter and abide in for a period of time and which can be developed, and which, if you do that, then leads to the outcome of leading out from samsara, of dispersal of your karma and so on, abandoning of wrong views and these kinds of things. So that's what Lokuttara Samadhi means in the context of the Abhidhamma. And I would say that at its simplest or its most basic form, it simply means practice of jhanas by somebody who's a Buddhist and has right view. So, and I don't think you can, you know, I think that's basically pretty much what it means. So in later Abhidhamma, and so in the commentary in Visuddhimagga, it came to be interpreted as meaning one mind moment. Okay, so the Visuddhimagga will interpret this whole passage as referring to one mind moment, which happens at the time of attainment of stream entry. Okay, that's what this is referring to. So it's important to realize that here in the canonical Abhidhamma, there's no suggestion of mind moments, there's no suggestion of an instantaneous attainment, it's just the practice of jhana, which is leading towards liberation. Okay, is that reasonably clear? Yeah? So, with that in mind, we come back to the Samana Mandika Sutta and the question of entering the jhanas in order to abandon the unwholesome and wholesome intentions. Then this, we can now, with that in mind, understand what the commentary is getting at and be able to meaningfully interpret that, whether it's reasonable or not in this case. Of course, the fact that it's introducing these kinds of categories and ideas which are not found in the suttas immediately makes us wonder whether they're why they've interpreted in that way. Where do the unwholesome intentions cease without remainder? According to the sutta, one enters and buys in the first jhana and so on, and according to the commentary, that's the first jhana associated with the attainment of non-return. the Vaikuntha jhana, okay, with non-return. And for the ending of wholesome intention, ceasing without remainder, enters and abides in the second jhana, and again, according to the commentary, it's the second jhana associated with the attainment of arahantship. So, of course, there's many problems with that whole analysis. Why first and second jhana? Why, if it's talking about the attainment of, you know, stages of the path, why does it differentiate between the first and the second jhana, and so on and so forth? So it doesn't seem to be a particularly plausible interpretation. Let's see if Analia has anything on there. A closer inspection of the Samanamandika Sutta suggests the commentarial explanation to be unconvincing. According to the exposition given in the discourse, the cessation of unwholesome intentions takes place within the first jhana and the cessation of wholesome intentions within the second jhana. If the cessation of unwholesome and wholesome intentions were indeed a matter of non-returning and arahantship, as suggested by the commentary, then the first and second jhana mentioned in the discourse would be completely irrelevant as far as the cessation of intentions is concerned. In this way, the commentarial explanation renders the stipulation given in the discourse superfluous. Hence, it would seem preferable to take the indication given in the discourse at their face value and to assume the references to the jhanas made in both versions to be meaningful. In the case of the exposition of unwholesome and wholesome conduct, the cessation of unwholesome conduct may similarly be only a matter of refraining from misconduct, not necessarily of being a stream enterer. In fact, a stream enterer, though incapable of major evils, may still commit minor breaches of conduct. Hence, the commentarial suggestion that with stream entry all unwholesome conduct ceases without remainder would not seem to be fully appropriate. Along the same lines, the cessation of wholesome conduct might also be just a matter of avoiding attachment to one's wholesome behaviour, something possible even before becoming an arahant. So, That's quite a common idiom in the Pali, yeah.
But would that have anything to do with the way...
So here a carpenter, quite secluded from wholesome dhammas,
well,
enters...
Well, maybe you talk differently to the lay people when
Look, I'm sure that's in part just a part of the standardisation of the texts. But yeah, it's certainly an idiom in the Pali texts that... they use the vocative very frequently. If you try to translate that all the time in English, it becomes very wearying very quickly. So tend to sort of slim down the number of translations you bring it in, yeah. But, yeah, I mean... Hard to say. You know, you might think that the original, you know, basis of the teaching on, you know, livelihood and ethics was more appropriate for a carpenter. But then it's difficult to say without knowing who the person is. Maybe it was a carpenter with good samadhi. Maybe it was Jesus. I don't know. That's a bit early for that. But anyway, yeah, hard to say without knowing too much of the background. But, you know, points taken there. Okay, so now when a man possesses what 10 qualities... Do I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome and ascetic invincible and so on? Returning to the original theme. Here, Tapati, a bhikkhu is, possesses the right view of one beyond training, the right intention of one beyond training, the right speech of one beyond training. So the one beyond training, the aseka, is referring to the arahant. Okay, so the seka is the stream enterer of one's returner and non-returner, the trainees, and the aseka is the arahant, one beyond training.
Does it literally mean listener?
No, that's a different word. That's savaka. Savaka, yeah. Savaka is the listener, yeah. And the right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, so those are all the factors of the Eightfold Path, right? Then the right knowledge of one beyond training, samanyanena, and the right deliverance, samavimutti, of one beyond training. So he is introducing the tenfold path. And so this tenfold path, including the eight factors of the Eightfold Path, finishing with right knowledge and right deliverance, is something which is almost always ascribed to the Arahant, as here to the Aseka. There are actually one or two passages where it's talked about in the context of a stream enterer as well, but generally speaking, it's the Arahant who has these factors. And the basic idea here is that the Eightfold Path is the thing which is developed for the stream enterer and so on, and they have all those factors present. Once one's developed right samadhi, then from right samadhi, of course, gives rise to knowledge and vision of things as they really are, which is the right knowledge, and then knowledge and vision of things as they really are leads to right release. So in a sense that the Eightfold Path is like the cause of the arising of the right knowledge and the right release.
It's curious, kind of, you know, I don't think there seems to be many systems that would have talked about the Eightfold Path.
The Eightfold Path?
Yeah, as I said, like, I'm not sure.
There's hundreds.
But isn't it like in the Sutta Nipata? Sorry, in Uttara Nipata, it's not even mentioned.
That's because they're all in the Samyutta.
So no more than the Sutra? Because usually it's there ancient.
Yeah, there would. I mean, it'll be found somewhere in the Anguttara. It'll be found somewhere in the Anguttara. Yeah. It'll be found somewhere in the Anguttara, but just not so prominently. But that's just because of the way it's collected, that's all. You know, that's the basic way that the thing was structured, is that the central doctrines were collected in the Samyutta Nikaya, and then the other ones were put into the other in the other collections. They include them occasionally, but not very often. Same thing applies to every one of the major Samyutta topics of the Samyutta. So Satipatthana occurs rarely outside of the Samyutta. The five faculties, all of those things, even the khandhas. I mean, you look in the Digha Nikaya, you only find the khandhas mentioned a couple of times in the whole Digha Nikaya. It's an organizational thing, yeah. And according to the theory I developed when I was doing the history of mindfulness, is that probably in many cases that originally all of the suttas on that topic were actually collected in the Samyutta, and later some of them were removed, like say the Satipatthana Sutta were removed at a later date, so to give the reciters of the different collections access to those teachings. So for example, like the whole set of Bodhipakkhya Dhammas we saw just the other week in the, which one, what, one of the suttas? Where it gives the whole series of Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. So that's probably taken out and put in there so that the Majjhima reciters have access to that particular teaching. Okay, so there's the Tenfold Path. Now, interesting. Okay, so this is obviously included here because it's giving an inclusive teaching on what is the highest person, right? Rather than the very limited teaching on the highest person, which is given by Samana Mandika. The Buddha's included all of those qualities which he regards as being necessary, including the development of the right samadhi and the knowledge and wisdom and so on. So this is all the different factors which the Buddha's added to Samana Mandika's very limited definition of refraining from wrong speech, wrong action, wrong intention and wrong livelihood. And now he's then expanded that to say, not is it just refraining, it's also actively doing those right things. It's also doing them but not attaching to them, not identifying with them. It's also having an active sense of right effort in striving to do things, not just in merely being passive about them. It's including a transcendental dimension. It's including a dimension of understanding of them. And it's also including many other factors which are not included in those teachings. So it's only with all of those supplements and all of those additions to Samana Mandika's teaching that the Buddha's willing to accept that this is really the highest attainment. So I just come back to here just to have. Sorry? Yeah?
Wholesome
feelings.
Feelers.
Yeah.
And yet, at the very end, he said, so after you've done all that and practiced for the attainment, for the cessation of wholesome feeling, then he said he's perfected in, or accomplished in wholesome.
Yeah.
And what is wholesome? And perfected in wholesome. But how do you explain that?
And has the end position.
He's sort of abandoned it. It's all fixed, but it's perfected.
Yeah.
It sort of seems to be.
Yeah, well, it's very Buddhist, isn't it? You, the perfection of something is where you don't have it anymore. I think it, you know, really it's for what it's really getting at is you know, for the arahant, they still obviously use right speech and so on because they perfected the practice of those things, but especially in nibbana that they will completely cease. So when they nibbana, so but it's just always difficult to describe that state of the arahant because it is an ambiguous state. You know, they're not developing those things because they're not part of the path, they're not on a path anymore, but they still live according to them. So yeah, it's just that sort of cusp of that paradox of those who are sort of still in the world but not of the world. So just to if we compare that with the Chinese version here, blah blah blah. Whereas the Pali goes straight from the wholesome and unwholesome conduct and analyzed according to the Four Noble Truths. And then goes straight from there to the 10 factors of the Arahant. But the Chinese gives a more gradual transition between those two different things. According to the Madhyama Agama version, the Buddha described how a noble disciple, based on knowing conduct and thoughts in their wholesome and unwholesome manifestations, and from the perspective of their arising and cessation, develops the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. The Madhyama Agama discourse presents these factors in a conditional sequence, indicating that based on right view, right intention arises, based on right intention, right speech arises, and so on. So this is one of the presentations of the Eightfold Path, which you find from time to time in the suttas. That is, each factor conditions the arising of the next. Endowed with the right concentration that's been developed based on the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, the noble disciple will be able to reach liberation from desire, anger, and delusion. Once such liberation has been accomplished, the noble disciple has become an arahant endowed with the 10 factors of one beyond training. One endowed with these 10 path factors, the Chinese version concludes, has indeed reached the highest and become a supreme recluse. Presentation of the Chinese version is convincing, offering a more gradual transition from the topic of conduct and thoughts to the attainment of full liberation. Such a more detailed treatment of the path to liberation would seem to accord well with the main thrust of the discourse, which took its occasion from the mistaken belief that to become a supreme recluse requires merely wholesome conduct and intentions. Okay, so then Analia contrasts that with the position taken by the Pali commentaries, which talks about the attainment of the various stages of awakening, even in the preliminary part of the discourse. So the Chinese, he says, preserves a more reasonable kind of gradual framework there. So I think there's probably something to that. So this is the Samana Mandika Sutta. Yeah. No, I'm not aware of that section. No. No. Yeah.
It's clear if you didn't have the commentaries about this idea about the screen editor. Because I've heard it many times.
Stream mantra?
Yeah.
Analia discusses that somewhere. The stream mantra would be unable to commit a serious breach of the five precepts, and gives some references. Then the Ratna Sutta in the Sutta Nipata indicates that for a stream mantra, that whatever evil deed they may do by body, speech, or mind, it is impossible for them to cover it up. Kinchapi so kaman karoti papakan kayena vacha udachetasa va ababosa tasa paticha daya. Impossible to conceal your breaches of conduct. This statement would be meaningless if, with stream entry, indeed all unwholesome conduct had ceased without remainder.
Okay. Like, say, stream entry very good.
Yeah, well, presumably they've you know, because they've got rid of various kinds of fetters which would lead to certain kinds of misconduct, then there would be certain things which they probably couldn't do, but then there may also be other things, or there would be other things which they would learn through experience as well. But yeah, it's not something which is discussed really in the suttas about the what the stream entry gets reborn actually does.
I think it's also an interesting reference about
read the sutta. It says he undertook the training on his deathbed. It means he was only on his deathbed that he became a stream enterer. He was a drunkard beforehand. This one has been a beacon of hope for countless practitioners. Well, he lost his jhanas and stuff after he started doing all the bad things.
So before that he was so
sick? Yeah. Yeah, afterwards, yeah. He became seduced by gains, honours and fame.
Is it commentary that says he did the thing, the snake routine, or is that in the sutta? You know, he appears a little more in the routine?
That's in the Kandikas. The underlying problem with Devadatta really is spiritual conceit, you know. And this is really the problem that the whole Devadatta story is pointing towards, that he's got some kinds of attainment and then that's the underlying problem. Yeah, you could, but it's just that the mind is very tricky, that's all. So I mean, you would at that time, but also you forget, you know. So, and then the mind just gets distracted by things and gets easily confused and so on. So this is why, and it happens. It happens in real life as well. There are plenty of examples of monks who get jhanas and then end up drifting off the path or whatever. It's by no means an automatic thing. I mean, if you ask them which is better, of course they'll say the practice of jhanas is better, but that doesn't mean you actually do it. You don't always do what you know is the right thing. You know? It's the same thing. You ask an alcoholic, is it better to be a drunkard or to be sober? And say, well, being sober is not better. Pass the scotch, you know. That's not really found in the sutta. That's just found in the commentary somewhere. But look, I don't know. I don't know if it's anything specifically to do with that. It seems to me more just a kind of an expression that Buddha's a fairly nice religion, and we don't want to condemn him to hell forever. But he's going to be punished. But then after that, he'll be okay. You know?
And he was quite young and had meditated very hard, put in the effort and you know, he was actually in the county of drugs himself, what his experiences, and he did attend really probably China. And but then just went, he ended up and asked him up very well and just slowly, and he said it was quite obviously didn't have a very good time for a long time. But he said that it just was too quick. He sort of really gave us a lot of put all his energies into it.
Mm-hmm.
But he said there was a whole lot of other parts of the path that he didn't pay any attention to. So it's like just getting the jhanas. He said anyway, he wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually didn't practice for 25 years, I mean, being sort of effective practicing.
And it's similar to this with David Dutt, who changed it with all his stuff in his first range retreat. So,
Is this not by the woman who's the exhortation to be satisfied with early success?
That's right, yeah. But also, that's actually quite realistic, because people who get these things very easily often don't appreciate it. And that you take it for granted, you know, maybe you've got some good practice from past lives or something like that. Go away, do a retreat, get into jhana. Wow, that was nice. You know, you assume that you can always go back and do it again, you know, and you don't really appreciate the work or the effort that it takes. Yeah.
Don't realise that in your past lives you were.
Yeah, that's right.
Grinding away.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's not people coming like, you didn't make it, you didn't do it.
Mm.
It happened.
Yeah, it's just cool. So,
how clever you are.
It's got a big ego.
Right, so let's finish up. Next week, Kwanjima 78, Chula Sakaludani.